The second case for oral argument this morning is Greg and Sharon Schwartz, appellants versus Sally Morgan, appellee. For the appellants, we have Ms. Sabrina Saylor, an attorney from Dakota Dunes. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Robert Deck, an attorney from Sioux City, Iowa. Ms. Saylor, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sabrina Saylor, and I represent Greg and Sharon Schwartz in this matter. On December 17th and December 18th of 2008, we asked 12 jurors to listen to all the evidence in this case, weigh the credibility of the witnesses who testified, and render a decision. Those 12 jurors unanimously returned a verdict, finding that Sally Morgan, the defendant in this matter, had omitted to disclose some encroachment issues to my client, had knowledge of the encroachment issues, was statutorily bound to disclose these issues, that her omitting telling my clients about the encroachment was done with the intent to deceive my clients for the purpose of inducing them to buy real estate she owned, that my clients did in fact alter their position and purchase the real estate because they did not know about this encroachment, and that they were damaged by that act. In the trial court's JNOV ruling, the court based its ruling, the court overturned that unanimous jury verdict because it concluded that there was no evidence that Sally Morgan knew of any encroachments from or on the adjoining property at the time of the sale in 1997. Under SDCL 43444, the property disclosure statutes, Sally Morgan only has a duty to disclose if she has knowledge of the encroachment and whether there was sufficient evidence presented to the jury that proved that she had knowledge of the encroachments at the time of the sale is the crux of this case and the basis for this appeal today. And so what I wanted to spend a little bit of time doing is talking about what specific evidence was presented to the jury that allowed them to return the unanimous jury verdict that they did. First of all, the evidence established that Sally Morgan built this home, that she had this exact driveway in question put in, and that that location of that driveway had never changed since she built the home. The evidence also showed that there was about five pieces of property that were affected by this case. Obviously, my clients only owned one, and that's the issue in court today, but that there was an attempt to replat these five pieces of property done back in 1990, and that replat attempt was signed by Sally Morgan. That a short time later, they vacated that plat, and the vacation of that plat was also signed by Sally Morgan. It was appropriate for the jury to make an inference that that replat attempt and the later vacation of that replat was obviously done for some reason. Sally Morgan testified that the reason it was done was because her neighbor wanted to put up a garage by his house, and the driveway was at an angle that didn't allow that to happen. However, she also testified that she helped pay for that 1990 replat, which would not make sense if it was solely done for the convenience of her neighbor. So if he could build a garage, so why wouldn't he have paid for it? The jury is permitted to hear all of the evidence, weigh the credibility of the witnesses that testify, and make any reasonable inferences therefrom. I also brought, and I'm going to apologize a little bit in advance because I'm going to quote directly from the transcript in a couple places, because I think that's the crux of this case, is what evidence was in front of this jury that she had knowledge of the encroachment. So there was a question asked during the trial of Sally Morgan that says, so I mean, back then you're saying that there was a discrepancy between how they were platted and how the properties were built, correct? Her answer, I'm confused on what exactly. The lots were run at a crazy, if you look at the original, they were run at a crazy angle. And so like 20 feet was where, would have been like over by in front of the neighbor's house, and everybody just mowed straight. And so we were just going to deed the 20 foot from each one to each one and replot it. And so it was just the way it was looking because the canal is like this indicating, and the road is like this indicating. And the developer put them at an angle kind of like, I suppose, to get more lots out of the property. And so that's what the problem was. So everybody owned. Like, I had a lot plus 20 feet on another one and 20 feet on the other one. And that was decided so that we could place our house in the middle of the lot and then have setbacks and stuff. Question was asked, so you were trying to square it off with the road? Her answer, well, yes, we were trying to square it off. You can say the road or the house or whatever, but it was just the way that you seen them was not the way that the lots ran. Again, another question asked. So you guys were trying to make it? You tried to change it back then to make the lot straight with the road? Her answer, well, I guess that's what you might call it. Later on, she, when referencing an earlier deposition question, she says, it was going to be for convenience because if I didn't get along with my neighbor and my yard goes over by his in the front of his yard and I mow half of it, we're not going to be very good neighbors. She also testified that she knew where the lots ran. Yeah, another question was asked, and you guys were trying to change them so that they ran straight with the road, correct? Her answer, yes. Again, later on, she says, and so we all got together and was talking and said, well, let's just do this and straighten it out so that Rick can do this. And it would be, it was a convenience for everybody, and then we wouldn't have to have any question about whose yard is being mowed. So she acknowledges there was questions about whose yard was being mowed. She acknowledges it was a problem, and so that's what the problem was, she says. Later on, she says, you thought that the question was asked of her. You said that you thought you guys had been mowing straight because you thought that was your yard, right? Her answer, we knew it wasn't our yard, but that's how everybody did it. Question, so they mowed on the neighbor's property? Answer, well, yes. If we were mowing straight, we would have to be mowing on the neighbor's. Question, and for the driveway, you had to go in straight to your property, correct? And she answers, that's correct. So if she knew that the mowing, they were mowing straight, they weren't mowing on their property because by mowing straight, they were mowing on their neighbor's property, and then you have to drive in straight to the driveway. It's very clear that that would be enough evidence or clearly sufficient evidence for the jury to make a reasonable inference that if you had to drive straight into your driveway and they were mowing straight and they knew that was on their neighbor's property, that she acknowledges that was the problem. She acknowledges, you know, so that there would be no question about whose yard was being mowed. Very clearly, I think the jury's permitted to listen to her evidence, listen to her testimony, weigh her credibility, and make the determination that they did.
But what law required her to disclose? When she sold the house to the Schwartzes, what law was in existence that required her to disclose this?
The property disclosure statutes require that the seller of every residential real estate provides a property disclosure statement, and I can give you the exact site.
Well, I know the site, but the property disclosure statute, I know you started a cause of action on that as well, but the statute of limitations had expired on that.
And that you're exactly right.
So how could the property disclosure statute be used still as a requirement of a duty to disclose
because
if it had expired?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There are two separate causes of action. There's a clear cause of action under the property disclosure statute, and had we been allowed...
That cause of action was foreclosed, right? So
right.
Now you have
correct.
One... So there's only one left.
Right. But I'm just saying that there is a distinction between the two. I mean, had we been able to proceed under the one, it's a little bit less of a bar. To distinguish between the two causes of action, to look at the deceit cause of action requires two things specifically that the property disclosure statute cause of action does not require, and that is you have to prove the intent to deceive, and you have to prove that that was done for the purpose of inducing reliance by my client.
Well, you also have to prove a duty to disclose, right? You also have to prove that the deceiver had a duty to disclose this before you can show
mm-hmm.
that they'd... Okay, but where does that come from? Where does the duty to disclose come from? You said the duty to disclose statute, but that cause of action had expired.
And so we clearly couldn't base a cause of action on the duty to disclose, but we could use the fact that there was that duty that existed at the time of the sale to prove just one element of
So
the
what
duty.
You're saying then, if I understand, is that the statute of limitations on the duty to disclose never expires, because if the 6 years goes by and a person has failed to disclose, they can be sued for failing to disclose because they're concealing it. So it never expires.
No, I think I would respectfully disagree, Justice Cunningham. And the reason I would respectfully disagree is because I think that the statute of limitations can clearly expire on the property disclosure statute. In order for us to be successful in the deceit, we had to prove that there was an intent to deceive and that it induced reliance. Under the property disclosure statute, you don't have to prove that. So all we're doing, and this case clearly in Ward versus Lange, a South Dakota Supreme Court case, has held that a statutory duty or a duty imposed by statute can create the liability, can create a basis for liability under 2010-1 and 20.
Sure, but in Ward versus Lange, the statute that we were relying upon, the enforcement of that statute hadn't expired. Here we have a statute, the enforcement of which has expired. The legislature seems to have said to home buyers, if you wish to bring suit against someone who has failed to disclose or not properly disclosed problems, you have to do it within 6 years. But what seems to have happened here is that the 6 years expired and the court's saying it doesn't matter. You still have a duty to disclose no matter how many years go by.
Well, I think what the court said, and they did hold that statutory duty in 43-438 did provide a basis or one of the elements for the deceit cause of action. But again, for us to be successful on this deceit cause of action, we had to prove a higher standard. And so
But an essential element of your cause of action is still the duty to disclose. Unless there's a duty to disclose, it doesn't matter whether they deceived or withheld information. They still have to have that duty, right?
Right, but if
is there any duty beside? Was there any other duty to disclose that was shown in the trial other than the duty required by the statute that had expired, 43-438?
No, Your Honor.
That statute really is what creates the duty to disclose. And I guess I'm trying to find out why that statute, the duty would exist beyond the 6 years.
Well, I don't think that finds that the duty existed beyond the 6 years. I think what that finds is that the duty existed at the time of the sale, and I think that's the vantage point that the court was looking at. The reason that the case was permitted to proceed beyond the 6 years was because it was a fraud case, and under the fraud case, the statute of limitations, the second statute of limitations applies that says that, you know, essentially in an action for relief on the grounds of fraud, that cause of action shall not be deemed to have accrued until the aggrieved party discovers or has actual or constructive notice of the facts constituting the fraud.
So if I discover that the disclosure statement that was given to me 50 years ago, assuming that could have been done, I can go ahead and bring suit and say, well, that person had a duty to disclose 50 years ago, and they didn't do it, and that's a concealment, and therefore I have a cause of action, even though the statute of limitations had expired 44 years ago.
Well, and I think that we were not permitted, and I think the trial court correctly found that we were not permitted to proceed on the 43 cause of action or the statute 43 cause of action. But there also is a statute, Justice Koenigkamp, right in those 43 causes of action that says that nothing in these statutes prevents a party. 43-442 specifically states that nothing in these statutes shall preclude or restrict any other rights or remedies of the buyer. And so
that alludes to some other duty that exists. But you're telling me the only duty exists is in this section 44. I mean, if there were some other common law duty that they had to disclose that was breached, obviously that would be part of the concealment. But if the only thing is in 44, it's difficult for me to understand how that can continue on indefinitely, because it seems to me that violates the legislative intent of saying, buyers, you better bring a cause of action for a failure to disclose within 6 years or you lose your opportunity.
And I think you just said it perfectly. We have to bring the right for the failure to disclose within 6 years. That deceit cause of action doesn't say that. I mean, the hallmark of a deceit cause of action is that fraud occurred. Fraud then relies on a different statute of limitations section that says.
But it still relies on the same duty to disclose. It still relies on the same statute.
It's just one element of it. I mean, it just provides that the duty arose out of
statute.
You have to
prove every element. You have to prove every element, don't
right.
you? I mean,
But I'm just saying that the difference is it's not a cause of action based on Chapter 44. We're using that to just prove one element, and the trial court correctly found that you know that duty did arise at the time of the sale in 1997. I mean, I think that the vantage point is when was that duty there, and it was done at the time of the sale, and very clearly that duty did exist in 1997. To overturn the trial court's decision in this matter, my clients have to show an abuse of discretion, and to many this might seem like a high burden to overcome. However, as pointed out by this court very recently in Neb versus Davis, a case handed down earlier this month, that where the decisive issue is one of fact, such as it is in this case, application of this standard means reviewing the testimony and evidence in a light most favorable to the verdict of the non-moving party, then without weighing the evidence, deciding if there is evidence which would have supported or did support a verdict. Thus, in reviewing what the abuse, you know, whether an abuse of discretion has occurred, I think it's necessary to look at what the scope of the trial judge's discretion was. Where the judge has broad discretion regarding a particular action or a decision, like where it acted as the finder of fact, well, then very clearly that finding abuse of discretion is a high bar because they have a lot of discretion. However, where the judge's ability to act is limited by a very narrow scope of discretion, such as the case in here, that standard is not so daunting. Here, as in Neb versus Davis, the issue is factual, and the specific factual issue presented to the court today is whether there was sufficient evidence to submit this case to the jury. And I went through, probably ad nauseum, all of the evidence and all of the testimony that existed. And it seems a little bit like perhaps the court was looking for some direct evidence of fraud. And especially in a fraudulent concealment case, I would submit on behalf of my clients that would be somewhat rare, that, you know, you'd have to have some kind of a written document or an acknowledgement that, yep, I purposely did not tell them and I did it, you know, so that they would buy this house. I mean, that would be rare. But as pointed out by this court in Harn versus Continental Lumber, short of the defendant admitting knowledge, the only sources that the jury can rely on proving knowledge is going to be the defendant's conduct and the surrounding circumstances. And if you take her testimony and the various things she said, the fact that she calls this a problem, the fact that she says there was a question, you know, just we're going to eliminate any question, the fact that she said when they mowed straight, they knew they were mowing their neighbor's property. She openly admitted that. Well, I think when you take
duty in the sales agreement, didn't your client waive a survey?
My client did not waive a survey. I mean, I think the testimony presented at court.
That one was in the sale agreement?
I mean, there was a survey done, and there was a mortgage survey. And I understand that
your client chose not to. Normally, doesn't a buyer of property, isn't it their responsibility to make sure they know what they're buying? And your client did not check the box for waiving the survey to be done to determine where the four corners of the property were.
And I understand that the defendant has made that argument, the waiver argument, but the clear law in South Dakota establishes that in order for waiver to be applicable, they have to have a clear knowledge of what it is that they're waiving.
Well, they waived the right to know where the lot lines were, didn't they?
No, they didn't, because they didn't waive their right to receive the property disclosure form, which the South Dakota law clearly puts that duty on every seller in a residential sale. And in order for the doctrine of waiver to apply, the person has to have full knowledge of all material facts. So that was not done here, and so therefore the right to disclosure of the encroachment is not waived. They also make some attempt to argue that there was an as-is needed or an as-is provision put on that purchase agreement. Well, the as-is thing specifically talked about two different parts, the deck and the retaining wall. So if we were here on an issue with regard to the deck and the retaining wall, I think we'd have to concede they took that as is, and they waived the right to proceed on that. But because they only accepted those two specific parts of the property, there's no mention made in the as-is clause about any driveway encroachment, which is what the issue that we're here in front of the court. And so my clients would respectfully assert that the doctrine of waiver does not apply in this case.
Okay.
In conclusion, and I know my time is running out here, but in conclusion, I guess what my clients would like this court to look at is what was the specific evidence in the transcript, and again, I kind of went through that ad nauseum probably, but her specific testimony, and based on that evidence that was submitted to the jury, and understanding that the law says that they are permitted to make all reasonable inferences therefrom, was there sufficient evidence for this jury to meet that element that she had full knowledge of the encroachments? And my clients would assert that there very clearly was that evidence presented, that they were permitted to make those inferences, weigh the credibility of all the witnesses who testified in this case, and return the unanimous finding that they did. And we would ask that you reinstate the jury verdict.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Saylor. Mr. Dick, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Saylor. I understand the plaintiff's concentration on the inference and the fact that they want the verdict reinstated based upon these legitimate inferences. I noticed in the brief they concentrated on the six words that were recited by the defendant in response to one of the questions, which I feel were taken out of context. Now this morning they've expanded the breadth of this argument, saying that there's other evidence that they feel also supports this argument. But I think that we still have the same problem, or that the plaintiffs do. The appellant states that this right of theirs to the legitimate inferences in the context of weighing the credibility of the witnesses, but there is no conflict in the evidence here to be weighed. The plaintiff offered no direct evidence that there was any knowledge of the defendant of the encroachment problem, which is why, of course, it brings them to the fact of trying to prove that based upon inferences. The problem there is that they're asking for two inferences, in other words, an inference on top of an inference. The first inference that the plaintiff asked this court to accept is that the defendant knew the exact location of the boundary lines, which there is no testimony or any direct evidence to indicate that she did. And what she indicated was is that the residents of this area mowed their lawns. That's the only thing that she testified about, is the mowing of the yards in a different direction or angle than was the actual boundary lines.
Were these like Z lots, or, you know, how are they, were they all a little different, or?
No, the lots, there's the lots are built around the canal, and then, of course, there's a road around in front of the houses. The lots were platted perpendicular to the canal, which turns out not to be perpendicular to the road. They're perpendicular to the canal, but the people built them perpendicular houses, perpendicular to the, or actually parallel to the road.
They were rectangular lots.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And so therefore, the lots run this way, and they built their houses this way, and they turned it a little bit this way. But as the defendant testified, we knew that we were doing that, and everybody built their property. In other words, there is direct testimony from the defendant. She built that the people built their houses within their lot lines. They simply built them instead of at the angle to the road, I mean to the canal, they built them at the angle to the road, which obviously is easy to do without any type of encroachment. And so therefore there were no encroachments that they knew about. Also along that line is the fact that she testified that she built her house in 1970, and from 1970 through, you know, for 25 years, there was never any problem that ever came up. She testified that the houses next to her on either side sold on, I think it was like six different occasions, And there was a realtor who also testified at the trial to the same thing, that she was familiar with the area. It was the same person who realtor that was involved in this sale, and that the other houses in the area had also all sold during that time, all without any problems. So, in other words, there was no indication or no real indication or inference that any of the property owners, let alone this property owner, had any indication that there was encroachment. So, first of all, the plaintiff's trying to infer that she knew the exact location of the lot lines, and next asking you to infer that she also knew, besides knowing that, also knew that there was an encroachment, which I think the evidence clearly shows that she did not know. But as which has already come up this morning, our position is that there are other issues in this matter other than just simply that. The first issue is the matter of the ruling on the summary judgment. The court in this ruling on the motion for summary judgment, and I quote, said this, it said, based upon 43437XX or otherwise founded on failure to give the disclosure statement. It says any causes of action based upon the disclosure statement, the statute, based upon or otherwise founded on a failure to give the disclosure statement. Quite honestly, I don't know how the case got to trial because that's what it's based on. In order for the defendant to have a duty and to be bound to disclose something, then the only basis for that is the statute that says there's a disclosure statement, and the court said otherwise in its motion for summary judgment. So, therefore, you know, as we all know, sometimes, you know, cases kind of get out of control. The case should have stopped then, but then it gets to trial. And then we have the trial, and we move for a directed verdict, and the judge lets it go on. And I think it just kind of got it out of hand. The judge says, then he takes the motion for directed verdict under advisement, doesn't rule on that. Once again, honestly, we all know from practice that sometimes, you know, we trust the jury to bail these things out and put an end to it and solve the problem for everybody. Unfortunately, in this case, it didn't happen. So then we came to the post-trial motions, and at that point in time, the judge obviously said, you know, that's it. I've got to put a stop to this. This case, the evidence wasn't presented, but to prove the case. But more importantly, I mean, that's what he based his ruling on. But more importantly, the reason that the case was and should have been dismissed was the fact that there was no duty to disclose. Now, on the issue of the waiver, it says,
well, isn't that the issue? Does a duty continue even though the cause of action is barred by the statute of limitations? Isn't that what we're here about?
The waiver issue?
No.
I'm sorry, what was that?
The duty to disclose under Chapter 43, does that duty continue? Once you have that duty, is that extinguished because the cause of action under that disclosure statute is terminated?
Yes, I think when the statute runs on the disclosure statute, that puts an end to the duty to disclose. The disclosure statute, as stated by Ms. Saylor, provides that it doesn't foreclose other causes of action, but those other causes of actions have to have a duty to have somehow imposed a duty upon the defendant to disclose, and without that statute, there is no duty to disclose. The as far as the waiver issue is concerned, in this case, the plaintiff were offered in the purchase agreement an opportunity for two surveys. One is a property line survey, and I can't remember what the other one was called, but they mentioned two different surveys, neither of which the plaintiffs availed themselves of. And not only did they not avail themselves of them, But the words that were written on the purchase agreement were, quote, not needed. In other words, by the surveys it said not needed. So these plaintiffs made a conscious decision based upon what they knew of the property. They viewed the property. They consulted with the realtor, et cetera, and then chose that they didn't need a survey of the property. So they were given that opportunity and declined it. Then there is a small issue of the fact that the defendant wasn't the actual seller of the property. She was selling it on contract to someone else, that the deed went from the defendant to the contract buyers, the Martins, and then the Martins gave a deed to the plaintiffs, and this wasn't just a straw man transaction. This was something that there was a legitimate contract that had been going on for some time upon which the Martins had been paying on, and so it was a legitimate and arm's length transaction, and so therefore in yet another respect the defendant had no duty to the plaintiffs because she wasn't the one that gave them the warranty deed. And of course that then brings into play the issue of merger of your claims within the deed. In other words, she gave a warranty deed to the Martins, and then the Martins gave it to her and any to the plaintiffs, and any claims would merge into the deed because the purchase agreement no longer comes into play once there has been the warranty deed. Next is the last issue is the matter of constructive notice. The fact that this replat, that is one of the reasons, one of the strong points that the plaintiff raises in terms of why they think you can infer that the defendant knew of the encroachment, was the fact that they had tried to replat all of these lots in a previous time in the 1990s. And but the point is that that information was equally available to the plaintiffs. In other words, they had constructive notice of it, and constructive notice obviously under the law is the same as real notice, and so therefore they had the same information that the defendant had regarding the replat. So then the question becomes is what about this replat and why they were doing it? Well, the defendant thoroughly explained that at the time of trial. But it was not because there were any encroachments. There were no encroachments that anybody knew of. They were replatting it so that their neighbor could build a building or a garage that was not attached to the house that would not encroach upon someone else's property. At least they didn't think it would. They simply thought that this new structure that was being built might in some respect be too close to the lot line, and therefore they were trying to accommodate that. When they couldn't, they dropped the replat and everybody went on about their business, all blissfully ignorant of any encroachments that there might have been. Regarding the matter of a new trial, if this court were to reverse and send this back, then it is our contention that there should be a new trial based upon all of the issues. Our reasonings for that are set out in our briefs, and basically there's five of them. We feel one is the issue of the newly discovered evidence, which we think is important and relevant to the matter. And then also, then there's the matter of the evidence that was offered about the Martin affidavit, which was significant in that the court allowed the plaintiff's attorney to question the defendant regarding an out-of-court statement in an affidavit by someone who didn't testify. The plaintiffs tried to justify this based on the fact that it was impeachment testimony, but it wasn't impeachment testimony. Impeachment testimony is based upon statements made out of court by the defendant, not by someone else used to try to impeach them. Also, we feel that the strong point is we get back to the fact that the court admitted into evidence the disclosure statement, which brings us back to the issue that this was an error because any cause of action based upon the disclosure statement had expired, and therefore you couldn't use the disclosure statement and offer it into evidence as the basis for the defendant being bound to disclose any information to the plaintiffs. Then there's the issue of the attorney fees and the fact that there was admitted into evidence and attorney fees that were exhibit containing attorney fees and included a claim for or a recitation of attorney fees for the very trial of this case, which was beyond any attorney fees damages that they were entitled to. And well, I did mention this in my brief, but the on that issue, at the close of the trial, the transcript at pages 290 and 291, there's a colloquy that I had with the judge, whereas I said to the judge, he shouldn't be giving the jury this exhibit for them to consider because it contained these additional attorney fees and hadn't been redacted out, and so therefore they were being given irrelevant evidence that they weren't allowed to consider, and I would submit that is another reason why a new trial on all the issues is needed. Then last was the matter of allowing the jury to decide when the plaintiffs had knowledge, which I will simply rely on what I've said in my brief regarding that. Finally, to touch upon the plaintiff's reply brief, and I'll try and find some point I haven't already touched upon. And I'm afraid I've been so thorough that I have nothing more. So, therefore, if the court will allow me, I will forego my last 3 minutes. Thank you.
I'm sorry. You're from some city, so you probably don't have a lot of experience, but no attorney has ever been chastised in front of this bench for quitting early.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
Okay. Ms. Saylor, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Duck. I believe he started his argument and indicated in his argument the exact two words that we're arguing is the reason that this case should be overturned. He said that the plaintiffs provided no direct evidence. The law does not require that we provide direct evidence. And as indicated earlier, I think in this type of a case, a fraudulent concealment case, direct evidence would be rare. What the law requires is that we present evidence that allows a jury to make reasonable inferences and to look at the conduct of the parties involved in this case and examine the surrounding circumstances of the conduct involved in this case and make any reasonable inferences therefrom. We believe that that's exactly what the trial judge in this case did as well. He was looking for direct evidence, and I think that a review of the history of fraud cases shows that that would be relatively rare. It would be nice, but it would be relatively rare.
So was the encroachment on this case mainly was it a driveway or what ended
it
up?
It was a driveway.
That was my understanding. So what in her testimony or what in the indirect evidence should the judge have recognized as evidence of her knowledge? Because the trial court says there's no evidence. It doesn't say direct. It says no evidence. And from what you read to us, it sounds like she was talking about mowing lawns and so forth. She doesn't say anything about a driveway.
Well, the conduct is that these guys were mowing their lawn straight. They were mowing a lawn straight, and that they knew when they did that, that that meant that they were mowing their neighbor's property. It also says,
wouldn't that, by the very testimony, mean she's talking about a lawn and not a driveway?
But she also says that the driveway ran straight into the property, and I think I quoted that earlier, but she says that the driveway, to pull into the driveway, you had to go straight. So once again, if you knew, and she says, and he says, you know, that there's an inference that we were trying to make that she knew where her lot lines ran. No, that's not an inference. She specifically, in her testimony, said, we knew where our lots ran. We knew where our lot lines were. And the fact that they were mowing straight and that they meant that knew that that meant that they knew that they were mowing their neighbor's lawn when they were doing that, that they knew that the property wasn't conforming with the lot lines, that they knew that when you pulled into the driveway, you pulled straight into the property. All of those things together clearly permit the jury to make a reasonable inference that if you mowed the lawn straight and you knew that was your neighbor and you came into the driveway right there too, that you would have knowledge that that was your neighbor's, that was on your neighbor's property. And one of the questions I think that you asked Justice Meyer Henry, and again without kind of having the exhibits here, it's a little bit difficult to explain, but I will concur with Mr. Deck that what happened here is the canal kind of runs this way and the road runs this way. When the property was originally platted, when this defendant, Sally Morgan, owned it from the very get-go, when it was platted such that the lots would run straight with the canal. When they were built, the builders put them straight with the road, and such that there was a domino effect of about 20 feet or sometimes more on each end of the property. And in her testimony, she specifically acknowledges that the lots ran such that, you know, I had my lot plus 20 feet over here and 20 feet over there. Once again, all of that, a lot, with the attempt, the fact that they attempted to replat this property, they vacated that replat. Both of those were signed by her. Clearly, the jury's allowed to say, why are they doing a replat? What's the reason that they did a replat? And so all of those things together, we would present this, clearly gave the jury sufficient evidence to make the inferences and draw the conclusions that they did and support the jury verdict. I'm going to grab one. One of the final things, and I think I forgot to mention this earlier, another question specifically asked of Sally Morgan was, did you hear Sue Hansen, who's the realtor that he indicated, testify that everyone knew that there was this problem? Her answer, I didn't hear her say that it was a problem. She said everybody knew the lot lines ran at an odd angle. Question, and you acknowledge you knew that too? Answer, everybody that lived there knew that. My clients had moved in from out of town. They had never lived in this area. They weren't familiar with this area of the neighborhood. They did not know that. And what clearly South Dakota law provides is that Sally Morgan, if she knew that, if she knew there was a problem, which she says everybody knew that, everybody that lived there knew that, then she was required to disclose that in a property disclosure statement. She did not do that. That's an undisputed fact and not one that was raised by the defendant on appeal. The other thing that I want to talk about is that there was some testimony by Mr. Deck that the deceit cause of action, or that the summary judgment motion should have precluded any mention of this duty, and I think that perhaps you alluded to that as well, Mr. Klinikamp. But what we would say is that very clearly that summary judgment motion said that the deceit cause of action or the fraudulent concealment action survived. If you look at the statutes that indicate what do we have to prove a deceit cause of action, one of the things is the duty. And that's one of the things is there was an omission of a fact by one that was bound to disclose it. And what I would say is that there's a clear distinction between pursuing a claim under property disclosure statutes, which quite frankly would have been easier than the claim we had to pursue at trial in this matter, because there's not near as high of a bar set for that kind of a cause of action, and using that statute which exist and which existed at the time of the sale to show that there was a duty on her part to provide that. The other thing he says, and one of the things that talked about here, is that, you know, there was some notation of none needed by the survey. But I would ask that the court look at the timeline of what the duties are. Very clearly, those, again, property disclosure statutes say that that property disclosure form has to be provided before there is a purchase agreement put in place. And so had she provided this property disclosure statement, which is undisputed she did not, and had she disclosed that she had some knowledge of some encroachments or some problems, those kinds of things, very clearly, no reasonable buyer, nor would I say my people were reasonable buyers, would have said none needed. I mean, they were relying on the fact that their bank was going to require some type of survey, but had they had knowledge that there were some issues, very clearly they would have very likely gotten a survey. And so we would say that, you know, if you look at the timeline, it's not applicable here. Well, another argument he makes is that Sally Morgan was not the seller of this property. And 43.437 defines seller at subsection 4, I believe, defines seller as an owner of residential real property. Now, what's undisputed here is that if you went to the courthouse and looked at the records, she held record title to that property. She claims that she was selling the property on deed to another couple. In her testimony, she also says that was never reduced to writing. I mean, despite the fact it was clearly over $500, that was never reduced to writing. This contract for deed was just a verbal contract that never existed in any form. It's also undisputed that she never recorded anything with the Register of Deeds to reflect that there may perhaps be another party that might be the seller of this property. What's undisputed is that the parties that she claims to have been selling this property to on contract had gone through a divorce, were not living in the house together anymore, were not paying their mortgage payments together like they had done in the past, and that those payments had been delinquent on several occasions. What's undisputed is that in the very purchase agreement that she acknowledged signing in this case, it references in there some property that was going to stay with the house. And it says curtains will go with the tenant. That's the very, again, legal operative document in this case. And it references those people in that house as a tenant. My clients testified that when they dealt with this, when they were negotiating prices in this sale, that the only person they negotiated with was Sally Morgan, that was where they went to sign this contract. Very clearly, by fact of the name that she says, name of seller, Sally Morgan, on this purchase agreement, she publicly held herself out as the seller. And so my clients would contend that that argument is without any merit. The merger doctrine that he references, and I understand my time's getting low, a clear exception to that is fraud. And that's obviously the hallmark of a deceit clause of action. So we would, again, contend that that doesn't apply as well. And finally, as in Neb versus Davis, again, I would say that this issue is factual, that this trial court was permitted to enter a JNOV only if, when viewing all evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party and indulging all legitimate inferences therefrom, no reasonable mind could find that there was sufficient evidence to support the verdict. Thus, as in Neb versus Davis, the Supreme Court must look at the evidence and determine if any reasonable person could reach the decision that the jurors reached. And if the Supreme Court determines that reasonable minds could differ on this, an abuse of discretion has occurred, and we would ask that you overturn the trial court's JNOV and reinstate the jury award.
Thank you, counsel. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.